The 1995 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 350, Stories of Mormon Women Missionaries' Experiences, Issues of Power and Relationships, with Becky Johns, Lynn Matthews Anderson, Guinevere Nelson, Amanda McPeck, and Mary Beth Rains.
Hear from our panelists as long as we can, and hear from as many audience members as we have time. We'd like to welcome you to session 350 of the Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium 1995. This will be a panel discussion, the title of which is The Stories of Mormon Women Missionaries' Experiences, Issues of Power and Relationships. My name is Becky Johns, and I'll act as the moderator, but I think we need to say that this panel was actually proposed and organized by Emily Asplund. Is Emily here? Well, we want to thank her anyway for being willing to organize and put together the panel. She selected the participants on the panel and asked them to present their ideas, and we're very thankful for that. Let me introduce the panelists now, and then we'll go through a few prepared comments that they have in order as listed in your program. And then if we have time, and I'm sure we will, we'd like to invite questions and comments from the audience. I particularly would like to hear about female missionary stories, as that's my area of research interest right now. I'm doing my PhD dissertation on female missionaries. So I'm always interested in talking to former female missionaries and their experiences. Let me introduce Lynn Matthews Anderson first. Lynn is probably best known outside of being the queen of the internet universe. She's best known for her authorship of the easy-to-read Book of Mormon, which is a paraphrase, of course, of the Book of Mormon for readers, of unsophisticated readers, and it's been very helpful in our home with our children. She also has been very active in electronic discussion groups, and she's also been a regular, or I should say, a sometimes contributor to some LDS publications. Lynn served as a missionary in the Belgium Brussels mission, and she'll tell us more about that. Then we have Guinevere, Guinevere's next, right? Guinevere Nelson. Guinevere is a Master's of Arts candidate at BYU in rhetoric and composition. She was formerly a missionary in the Uruguay Montevideo. Did I say that anywhere close? Oh, well, not very good. But she's, when did you serve that mission? I thought I had that. Just a year ago. That was what struck me about Guinevere. She's very recent. And that'll be a nice contrast with some of our other panelists. Was that tactfully said? not that they're really old or anything, but it was a nice contrast. Guinevere will be attending law school next year, and she's currently acting as a publisher for, or an editor for a publishing company. Sorry, I got the wrong one. That's because both of you are having this honors thesis, and that's why I'm getting this mixed up. So Guinevere did her honors thesis, but it's unpublished, and it's called Sisters in the Field, Personal Narratives of Missionaries on Companionship. And she is presently working on her English bachelor's at BYU. And
Masters.
She has...
Masters.
Masters. That says, oh, I see. That's what she has already attained her bachelor's, and she's working on her master's. She has several publications to her credit, and she is in rhetoric and composition. Now we go to Amanda McPeck. Amanda's from Ogden. She's currently an editor, as I was trying to say Guinevere was, but it's Amanda. She has her BA in humanities from BYU, and she'll be going to law school next year. She is currently working in Ogden as an editor, and her area of interest is folklore and personal narrative women's studies. While she was at BYU, she started a journal entitled Voices, a Journal for Feminist Thought, which must be to her credit. So she'll tell us about her mission. And then finally we have Mary Beth Raines, which is probably a very well-known name in this group. Mary Beth is a clinical social worker, a marriage and family therapist in private practice. She has published numerous articles in Sunstone and Dialogue. And she, of course, was the co-editor of Peculiar People, Mormons, and Same-Sex Attraction. Mary Beth served in the Austrian mission in 1966-67, and she's the mother of three adult children and one very recent granddaughter. So we're pleased to have these panelists, and we'll turn the time now over to Lynn.
I always wanted to go on a mission, and some of you are probably familiar with one of... Oh, do you want to see me? Okay. Okay. I don't have anything here. This is just a security gimmick here. Some of you are probably familiar with one of my little personal stories about how when I was 12 years of age, I marched into my bishop's office and demanded that he make me a deacon. And, you know, after he recovered his breath from laughing, he did take me seriously. I'll give him credit for that. And I have wondered what it was that he replied to this that kept me in the church. And I vaguely believe, or at least I made up the story in my mind some years afterwards, whether it's true or not, I'm not sure, that he must have told me that if I lived long enough, I could be a missionary. And so I must have been placated by that hope and expectation. And I was always a complete fanatic about the church from earliest age. I had all the answers in Sunday school. I would regularly, no lie, I would regularly stand up in fast and testimony meeting and call the ward to repentance, particularly the rowdy deacon's quorum. So I guess I was somewhat taken aback when I did turn 21 after fending off a couple of people that I'm very grateful I didn't get married to and, you know, that sort of thing. And I did decide I was going to go on a mission, or rather I was going to fulfill that expectation and that goal that I had had for years and years. Somehow, my parents had not gotten this message. Don't ask me how. It kind of caught them by surprise, and they were somewhat opposed to the idea, probably just on financial principles. But and I remember being really upset, and I got down on my knees, and I was fasting and so forth, because I didn't, you know, I had actually went so far as to arrange for the elders' quorum and my ward to support me if my parents wouldn't. Here, my parents were very active people. But, you know, I was serious. But I didn't want to go if they were going to disapprove. So I got down on my knees, and I reminded the Lord that I'd always kept the word of wisdom, always paid my tithing. You know, I had just been straight arrow. I'd never done anything awful. Well, anyway, I'd never really done anything bad. And the next day, my parents were my enthusiastic supporters. I mean, it was really, to me, that was a real testimony of tithing and stuff, that my parents would have such an about-face. So I really wanted to go. Now, when my call came, I put in my papers, and a couple weeks later, I got a call, and I opened the envelope, and I was called to the Paris, France mission. And although I did not admit it at the time, I was a little disappointed because, yes, I'd taken 5 years of French in high school and college, but I'd also taken Spanish and some German and somehow it just seemed a little too doggone pat that this inspired call would be to Paris, France. How obvious. But I didn't say anything, and I had my farewell, and I had these flyers that I sent to non-Mormon friends with a picture of me holding suitcases in front of the Eiffel Tower, you know, and it was cute. And all the way up until the weekend before I was to enter the MTC, and this was the day after December 1st was when I was going in. So Thanksgiving weekend, I get a really weird call from Murdoch Travel, and they say, "Did you obtain your Belgian visa?" And I went, "Well, I'm not going anywhere near Belgium as far as I knew." And, well, somebody at the church office building had neglected to tell, I guess in the Thanksgiving preparations or something, neglected to tell me that I had had my mission call changed to the Belgian Brussels mission. And Well, you know, after a mad scramble to get everything arranged, I entered the LTM at the time. It got changed about a year into my mission to the MTC. And on my dresser to the in the room that I was assigned there, there was another letter signed by Spencer Kimball informing me that my call had been changed. I didn't know for a while why my call had been changed, but I felt a whole lot better about going to Belgium for some reason than going to Paris. Turns out that the mission president in the Paris, France mission, to whom I had written a beautiful letter of acceptance of my missionary call and was just, you know, gung-ho. I still have a carbon of it someplace, and I read it over and go, wow. I was just, you know, I was going to take the whole mission by storm, baptize thousands, well, teach thousands for baptism. I never got a response from the mission president. Turns out this guy did not like women at all and had specifically asked Salt Lake not to send him any more sister missionaries, and somehow they humored him for a couple of months, and I was one of the lucky sisters who ended up getting transferred from his mission to a different one. And this honestly and truly changed, you know, the impact. It would have been a life-changing experience to have gone on a mission anyway, but at least I ended up with what I would consider a fairly positive experience in the mission field. My mission president was James Aragona, who lives in Salt Lake with his wife, Anita. I love this person. He treated all of the missionaries with kindness and compassion. He was a wonderful man. In fact, when I was here last November, I went and spent some time with him and his wife. I'm grateful. When I went back to BYU after my mission, there was a person in my ward who ended up in this other mission president's mission and she was called like 2 or 3 months after I had been called. And she said this man made life a living hell for the women in the mission, that he would put impossible restrictions on their conduct, say that they could not proselyte or could not tract during certain periods of time, and yet still require them to have as many proselyting hours recorded as the elders. This is very difficult to do, especially in wintertime when, you know, the hours of darkness kind of overwhelm the hours of light. He would assign them to areas that were not conducive. Let's put it this way. Sisters lived in slums. They were mistreated in just about every conceivable way, and he treated them like dirt and had no use for women and wished that they weren't there and made that incredibly apparent to them. And it traumatized this young, brilliant young woman who was in my ward who had gone to that mission. To say that she was traumatized, that her life as a member of the church was essentially over after her missionary experience is not an exaggeration. You know, this man drove this woman out of the church, in essence. Maybe she managed to find a way to come back. I don't know. So, again, you know, to me, missionary service as a young woman is nothing more than an incredible crapshoot. It's true that it's the same for young men. You don't know where you're going to go. And your mission president can make the difference one way or the other. But that, I think, is even more true where women are concerned. They don't screen for misogyny when they call men to be mission presidents. They don't necessarily wonder or care whether the mission president's wife is a fascinating woman or an adult human being. I know a mission president's wife currently, and I've never met a more fascinating woman. This is something that I really think the church needs to examine closely, is it isn't whether or not the guy has a good military record or did well in, you know, IBM or some other male business. How does he relate to women? Otherwise, don't send women to these places. Women have a very good track record as missionaries. In our mission, the average for all missionaries was 1.2 converts for the entire mission period. The women did about 4. Now, remember, this is northeast France and Belgium before the Great Harvest or something. We were all considered ourselves dunners rather than harvesters. This is 1978-79. So, again, I personally feel like I had a pretty good mission. For one thing, I did not endear myself to the elders straight off the bat. My very first three-zone conference, I'd been there about a month, I got up and said something about how odd it was that here I, a college graduate, was amongst the freshman elders. And again, this really endeared them. My husband, and yes, I did end up marrying a missionary from my mission, but it wasn't like that. He didn't even make my secret list of elders I wanted to date afterwards. So be that as it may. So early on, some of the elders would mutter about, district leader Matthews, and I didn't really, some of these little guys, they try to tell us stuff, and I just laugh. How could you not? And my mission, and again, since my mission president wasn't a heavy-handed authoritarian type, he loved us, and, we all wanted to please him, and we all liked him because he genuinely liked us and cared about us. And yeah, there were some stupid statistics programs, and there are things that I would, I'd throw away the white handbook first off if I ever went on a mission again. And I'd sleep as long as my body really required it rather than to pretend that I could get up that early or not get enough sleep or whatever. There are things I'd do differently, but, for me it was a positive experience, and I'm very sorry that in the course of time over the years, as I have heard fellow sister missionaries tell of their experiences and tragic, stupid, sexist kinds of things that go on in lots of different places. I'm sorry, and I wish that I could say in good conscience to any young woman who is thinking about going on a mission, oh, sure, go ahead. But again, how can you do that? I in good conscience tell my own daughters, yes, go, without really feeling like I'd have to know who the mission president was going to be. I'd have to know more than what parents are generally given to know before I'd be willing to subject them. I've known people who have come back completely emotionally and psychologically crippled, people who have been physically decimated by this experience, and whose testimonies have been, for all intents and purposes, completely destroyed. It took me, 15, 20 years or something to get to, wearing sunstone earrings. But I know a lot of people who just kiss the church goodbye. I know a lot of people who have done that after their missions. So I can't really speak to the idea that there wasn't, we didn't have overt power in our mission, but then we were a pretty flat mission as it was in terms of hierarchy. It just didn't really matter. And the elders, by and large, tended to follow the lead of our mission president, as they tend to do in most missions. If you've got an authoritarian jerk for a mission president, then the zone leaders and the district leaders will end up being authoritarian jerks, nearly always. Birds of a feather and all of that. But if you don't, like I was fortunate to experience, I basically had good district leaders kind of live and let live. We were friends as well as co-workers in building the kingdom. Had good zone leaders. Even the assistants to the president that all of us thought were kind of, apes, or rather APs, even they were pretty good guys, they tried to be good examples, and they didn't usually offend too many of us all at once anyway. I married one, what can I say? So anyway, that was my experience, and I think the whole system needs a real intelligent look, and they certainly underutilize, for the most part, the women from, women should be zone leaders, they should be district leaders, having these little freshman elder guys trying to make decisions without input from the women they're supposedly in authority over, and failing to utilize the talents of women who are anywhere from 2 to 5 years older than these young men. It's just ludicrous. So that's my 2 cents. You have to go up there.
Historian Laura Thatcher Ulrich notes that in diaries, women tend to write more about relationships and men more about work accomplished. Women write about people and men write about things. This is a broad overgeneralization. And a lot of the comments I'm going to make are going to be broad overgeneralizations about general trends that women in my study tended to note. This is Laurel Thatcher Ulrich is a part of a branch of feminist scholarship which is focused on women's culture, looking at the way that women relate amongst themselves and how does that affect larger cultures, this little subculture. And I, getting back from my mission, was amazed at how when groups of sister missionaries get together, they tend to talk about their companionships, no matter how long they've been off their mission. They tend to focus on the companionships as the crux of the mission experience. Some of the women I talked to said that companionships almost propelled them to suicide, while others felt like good companionships had pushed them into self-realization and self-development. And so I did a study based on a few feminist philosophers in which I interviewed 10 women in in-depth interviews about their companionships and the way that they related amongst themselves as women. Sister missionaries have in companionships what Adrienne Rich calls the range through each woman's life and throughout history of woman-identified experience. The women have been cut off from the most intimate male relationships, but are very traditional women in general, not always. And they fill the gap of male companionship with female companionship. Nancy Choder claims that, in general, men are emotionally secondary in women's lives, that women have a richer, ongoing inner world to fall back on. Men do not become as emotionally important to women as women do to men. Now, I don't know if I necessarily agree with this statement totally, but I think it's a provocative springboard for some questions, because women in the mission do become more emotionally important to each other than do men, because they live with each other 24 hours a day and they eat and sleep with each other. So I posed these questions, taking a folklorist approach and looking at how the stories the women told about their companions reflected the values of their female subculture and the Mormon culture in general. And these women reflected remarkable similarities in the stories that they told. Here's some questions I'd like to pose. What do female relationships mean on a mission? Do sisters have different relationships than do elders? How are they different? Do they have a different moral view of their mission goals? How do companionships alter this? What does it mean to be female in a younger male world? And the women that I interviewed convinced me that fundamentally women have different, very, very different mission experiences than do men because of their perceptions of companionships. They believe, the women that I interviewed, that women have more intimate and intense relationships, that they rely more upon each other, and that becomes alternately a strength or a complete barrier to being able to work, depending on that relationship. Today I don't have time to discuss the implications of all the things that I did. It's an 80-page paper. But I find Carol Gilligan's analysis of women applicable to these women's perceptions of self as missionaries. These self-images are, quote, tenaciously embedded in relationship with others. In other words, in general, relationships and companionships defined and created the missions themselves. The women did not seem to be able to compete with their companions like elders did. They didn't seem to be able to release tension in the same way that elders did. They didn't seem to be able to work with the same moral codes that the elders did. They found themselves, although as missionaries, they have the same basic to convert people and to activate people, but I found that the women perceive themselves as having very, very different goals, very much more relationship-oriented, very much more numbers evasive, and they use their companionships as a reflection of self, as healers, as catalysts, and as buffers from the society. I don't want to say that these women did not have a positive experience. In general, the women that I interviewed had extremely positive reactions about their missions in general. They had negative experiences. They had positive experiences. But in general, they would not have been comfortable if I described their reactions in anything less than positive terms. I don't know. Do you want me to have the questions now or afterwards?
Well, why don't we do them after?
Okay, so basically I'm just proposing some of the implications and questions that were in my study, and if you have interest in this, you can ask more specific questions. I brought transcripts of the interviews so I can quote directly so that you don't have to get my filtered perception. Thank you.
I'm actually rather nervous. It's been at least a year since I've been in any kind of academic setting, so this is kind of weird for me. My particular research was actually on folk songs. I've also come from a folklore perspective, and I made a collection of a lot of the songs that sisters sang during their missions, and from those songs I was able to glean a little bit of what their experiences were and what their feelings were towards their mission. But unfortunately, that's not what I want to talk about today. As I've been sitting here in the symposium today, I've come up with a few things that have been on my mind for the past year when it relates to sister missionaries and their relationships and the relationship to authority in the mission, and that also reflects on our authority outside of missions. I'd also like to say I haven't been on a mission, so I'm coming from a little different perspective. I also want to say I believe the telling of stories are very, very important, and I think we need more sisters talking about their experiences. I don't think there's enough. When I think about this, I'd like to ask, when was the last time you sat in a Sunday school class and a sister spoke up and on a theological question said, well, on my mission, this is what we taught? It doesn't happen very often. Sisters don't share a lot of their experiences very often in that kind of setting, and I kind of wish they did. So anyway, the first thing I'd like to say is I think there's a perception among the general members of the church, and especially among my generation, that there have only been sister missionaries since 1980. Obviously, this is not true. There have been sister missionaries as long as there have been brother missionaries. I think we need to have more history of sisters' experiences throughout the continuum of time. I don't think we should focus on what is happening just right now. I think there's a lot that we can learn from sisters' missionaries' experiences in the 19th century as well as the 20th. I'd also like to kind of propose that going on a mission is a righteously rebellious act. I think going on a mission is kind of a way that a lot of sisters, at least right now, have of asserting an identity that is different from the so-called norm of the church while still being acceptable within the church. It is not expected in the same way for sisters to go on missions as it is for men, although it is getting to that point. I think just a second, let me gather my thoughts. It's obvious, or somewhat obvious, that if you're going on a mission at the age of 21, you're not married, which being from Utah is something somewhat strange around for women of the church. I have quite a few friends who were married before the age of 20. And so, in a way, going on a mission is a form of rebelliousness, is saying, I have my own life, I'm going to serve, I'm going to teach, and I have enough spiritual authority to teach someone about the gospel. I'd also like to say, coming from the perspective of not being a returned sister missionary, that while the noticeable presence of increasing numbers of sister missionaries make women more acceptable, is it making women more acceptable as religious and spiritual authorities? Is it only acceptable to teach when you're on a mission? Is it only acceptable to be a sort of spiritual authority when you're on a mission? I say this because from my own experience, my personal faithfulness and discipleship has kind of been called into question in my ward because I'm almost 23 and I haven't gone on a mission and I'm single. And this is even though I have spent my entire childhood going to church alone, without any parents there. Though I've been a member of the ward since I was 6 years old, of my own choice, got baptized of my own choice. I still have a lot of people looking at me askance because I haven't gone on a mission. Like somehow I'm not quite as faithful. Even though I'm not required to go on a mission, there's becoming a sort of feeling that sisters, if you're over 21, you have to go on a mission. And I'm not, and while that's in some ways it's a good thing, I'm not quite sure if it's, I'm thinking that it's not a wonderfully good thing. We need to ask ourselves what this does to authority in the sense of spiritual authority. I notice in my ward that the sisters who in my ward who have gone on missions, and I'm in a normal ward with my family now, they when they speak up in Sunday school, they're listened to and they're accepted as having experience within the hierarchy of the church, whereas I have not. And it's really rather painful. I think we need to ask if we are going to inflict that same kind of authority standard on women that we have on men, that test of faithfulness of the mission. And I think that's an important question. Although, obviously, we are here to talk about sister missionaries, I think we, at the same time, we need to talk about those of us who decide not to go on a mission for whatever reason. So that's really, those are kind of the thoughts that are have been circling around in my head. I'd like to say that I hope that several of the sisters that are in this room right now will come up later and tell us their experiences on a mission, because, like I said, I think it's a very important thing that we need to address. So, thanks.
I went on a mission in 1966 when only those women who went were weird and clearly unmarriageable. And it didn't actually occur to me to go. My grandmother had gone in the 1920s, and after my brother had gone a few months before I went, and I had finished a bachelor's degree at BYU, my grandfather suggested it to me, and it occurred, and it seemed like a good idea, like things often do when you're in your early 20s. And so I went, and I prayed fervently that I would not have to go to a country where I had to learn a language, and I was promptly called to go to Austria, and spent 3 months in the language training mission, a lot longer then, and I'm glad I did, because German was purely unintelligible to me when I got there for quite a period of time. I noticed as soon as I entered the language training mission that there were big differences between men and women, and one of the differences I noticed, given that there were, during that three-month period, only two sisters in my group of 10, and there were eight elders, they all roomed together. So there was a subgroup of connection that my companion and I had, who, by the way, was not going to Austria, and all the other men in the room were going to Austria, had with each other. And so it started a process for me of feeling, as I had in many other times of my life in the church, of feeling like a single person going through a group process. Now, who knows? Maybe I just projected that onto it because that had been my experience before and now it became that again. But in any case, I still had a great time in that setting because it was an academic setting and I knew I could do okay in an academic setting. The real test, of course, came when I got there. I would rather than give you the history of how I went from Salzburg to, you know, the end of Austria, out near Switzerland, and back to Vienna, and all of those kinds of things, I'd like to organize my remarks around two things that I will give you stories about. The first was the relationship to authority. I have to say, as Lynn said, I had a wonderful mission president. I'm sure it was totally by accident, but I would not have had the same mission had it not been him. He was a professor of German. He was very interested in German culture. He had been in Vienna, Austria at the time of the Anschluss, which is the annexation of Austria to Germany in the late 1930s. He was very interested. You know, he would take us to the art museums. He would explain all kinds of things. But what the most important thing he did for me was that he treated me like a person, and he explained church government to me. I mean, like real politics. And so here are my two stories. At one point, he decided to have an advertising campaign to make the Mormons a little more visible throughout Austria, and so he had it all together and had all the logos done and everything else. And President Benson, who was then the European area president, came through and said, nope, not that, and nixed it. And but the next day, all of it was taken down and put away, and he didn't say a thing. And I'd been in the mission home for several months at that time. I'd had a knee injury, and so it turns out that I couldn't tract, and I also was good at typing. So so I was his secretary, personal secretary. And so I went into him, and I said, why did you do this? You didn't even squeal. You didn't whine. You didn't say anything. Why did you do this? And he said, Sister Raines, when I get home from being a mission president, I'll be still a fairly young man. I would like some church jobs the rest of my life. And he would typically explain the inside logical reason how church politics worked, combined with his faith view of the church being true as it said it is true. And that ability to synthesize cultural relativity and faith absolute was enormously helpful to me because it matched where I was in my developmental stage. The other story, in terms of how he treated me and I believe other people as real people, I wouldn't say that all the elders in our mission or even maybe all the sisters would give exactly the same view as mine, because he could be quite efficient and brisk, and you know, anybody knows anything about Germans or German people who love Germans is that they can be quite crisp and brisk and on about things. But he called me in one time and he said, well, I'm stuck. I don't know what to do. It's time for the yearly interviews. This was his. He'd come on to be mission president the same time I had come, and so he had never done these yearly interviews. And so he called me in and he said, "I have to interview all the sisters as well as all the elders, of course, and I have to ask about sex. I have to find out whether they're morally clean, how they're doing, whatever. And I don't know how to do this without offending them. So, what's the best way to approach the subject so they don't feel invaded? So I get the answers I need to get. How shall I frame the questions?" I was stunned. I was complimented, and to this day I'm grateful to him for having that kind of insight about how women might be treated. He really liked women, I have to say that, in terms of getting along with women and down and chatting rather jovially, and so I think that helped enormously. The other story I have about him is that he, at one point in the same period of time, had to hold a church court on somebody in the mission, and he again didn't know how to do it, and he said, "Well, will you read all the books and the manuals and everything and then kind of just synopsize it for me and tell me what to do, because I don't know how to do this." And so he would regularly seek not only me out as a woman, but would seek also elders out for expertise and help, and he would clearly admit that he knew that he didn't know. The other piece in terms of a relationship to authority was my relationship with the other elders. And Lynn was, you know, had the same reaction I did, is that how is these people who are, you know, 2 or 3 years younger than myself, by the time I was out there over a year, and they have the authority, I don't, and I didn't really mind it for the most part, except when they acted very uppity. And just by fiat said this or that was supposed to happen. And but I discovered a very good way of nullifying all that and leveling the playing field, which was to use very complicated words and complicated syntax. And it stopped them cold, actually. I also learned to listen to the way they joked around with each other. And I knew that a lot of them talked a little bit about girls and women and who they observed. And in one case, there was an elder who I'd known who was in my ward before I came out, and he was really good at being quite affectionate with the girl next door. And so just by listening to those stories, you could drop a few words about that, and they would stop cold also. Unfortunately, it kind of added to the whole thing about women being indirectly manipulative, right? At least I was consciously indirectly manipulative. I was in the mission home for about half the time that I was on my mission. During those years, it was I was a full 3 months in the language training mission and then a full 2 years out, because evidently I had spent so much time teaching us the language, we were supposed to stay out there for the same amount of time. So I was in the mission home a lot. I had to come home some months early because I had a knee injury, and then I kept having knee surgery there, and so finally I needed to come home, but it was only a few months early. And so I had, for the better part of the time, the whole time I was in the mission home, we had an uneven number of sisters in the mission, so I never had a companion while I was there. And so the only people I knew, I was around all the time, were other elders who were not assigned to companionships either. And I think there were an odd number of elders in the mission home, even though we each had our particular job in our own offices, and we ate and slept and worked all in the same building, on a four-story building in the outskirts of Vienna. And so family, along with the mission president's family living there with us with his six children. So we had this large group of people who kind of went up and down with roles, and we would tutor his kids, and they would come down and would entertain them, and we'd all have dinner together. And, you know, this whole thing kind of, it worked in some ways, and at times it didn't work. But what I'm trying to say is I got to know boys and men for the first time as people's friends because of the hands, you know, arm's length kind of thing. And given that I had grown up on the coast of Oregon and I was the only Mormon in my class and grade and my father would not let me date anybody outside the church, this was a way to have a close-up view of what boys were really like because I had not dated very much at that point. And so it was very, very helpful to see friendships, to develop long-term discussions, to have debates over the dinner table, which our mission president encouraged, by the way, around various kind of topics in addition to gospel topics. And so in that sense, there was a more equal influence because I had more equal access. I do not think that's true of sister missionaries who only work in teams with another sister and then with other groups where you come and meet occasionally or once a week, and that will be that experience. And so you don't have the inside view of things, and actually it may set up more competition. Also, by being the mission secretary, everybody knew I knew all the details about them. So that had also a leveling influence, I think. The other thing is in terms of relationship. I had four women companions during the period that I was out of the mission home and out in the field. Two were English-speaking and two were native German. And of that period of time, I had two English-speaking companions, both of whom I liked and we got along really well. And that was for a total of 4 months. The rest of the time I was with native German speakers who had no knowledge of English whatsoever. And in one case, her father had been a prisoner of war and had been in America and hated Americans. And she, now I know, was seriously mentally ill from the hindsight of being a therapist now. And so those were tremendously difficult times to be isolated in language. Particularly one was right at the first of my, near the first of my mission. And I have never felt so isolated in my life as during those times when I couldn't communicate fluently enough and I'd had no contact with other elders except for once a week during church. And yet it's also times when I had to dig the deepest. And one of the things that we haven't talked about yet is the inside experience of what your spiritual journey is while you're on a mission. We've talked a little bit about power relationships and about relationships, but I have to say digging deep during those times when there were no other resources was tremendously useful to me because it cut down to the bare bones of what did I believe, what was I doing, 24 hours a day in a place I couldn't understand in the cold, and I have to say the Austrian cold during the winter is probably, that's probably bad as it is in Belgium, highly humid and very cold, and it really pulled me inside in a way that I hadn't had the experience of before. And I have to say I'm tremendously grateful for those experiences. The last the thing I want to talk about in terms of relationships is that the relationships I developed on my mission were tremendously useful to me in some ways in terms of not only friendships, but the actual people I developed relationships with. But now that my children are adults, there's another thing that's come into play that I'm tremendously grateful for. I didn't marry someone on my mission, but I married the brother woman missionary. She and I had been in language training mission roughly the same time, even though not in the same group. And even though I was really never close to a lot of the other women missionaries in the mission because I wasn't out in it as much, and then it was mostly with German missionaries, we still really liked each other, and so every time conferences would come around, we'd talk or we'd send notes here and there, and I married her brother, and she married another male missionary in the mission. So for the last 25 years or more, almost 30 years, there's been this ongoing familial relationship of former Austrian missionaries who are now, you know, all still related to each other, and that's been helpful to kind of check back and forth and as a way of reinterpreting what went on, what I experienced, what she experienced,
We don't talk about it all the time, but last Sunday, my granddaughter's baby blessing, we spent about an hour talking about them. And so there's been this reinterpretive experience I've had with her and her husband that's been tremendously available, and I had for a number of years with one of the English companions, American companions. And so I would say, for a lot of sister missionaries, that ongoing relationship is still important, and it's actually acts like other long-term female companionship, is that it's a way to understand what you're going through, but over time, it's a way to completely reinterpret again and again and again what you went through. The last thing is that my son went to Switzerland on a mission. He came back 2.5 years ago, but while he was there, all the boundaries had been redone in the previous 25 years, and he ended up in the two towns that I was in Austria, because the Swiss mission at that point was part of the Austrian mission. I mean, they were changed the boundaries. He ran into some of the same people that I had known there, and that his aunt and uncle had also known there. And there's been something important happen about him coming back and us talking about not only having a common language, but having both gone on a mission, and both having gone on a mission in the same language area, in the same cultural area. And that is that it's been tremendously difficult being a single mother, feeling like I had a common experience with my children, given that I was mostly a managerial mom. And now I have the experience of being on the inside of a similar experience as he has had. And I think my experience of talking to other males who have been on missions is somewhat dissimilar, that you've been inside the same experience. And I don't, in most of my discussions with them, talk much about power hierarchies kinds of things. But there's something about having experience going out day after day in the mind-numbing cold, knowing you're not going to see anybody, hearing from each other the same kind of language tricks. There's something about being on the inside of the experience that matches stories of childbirth, that matches, how we've done testimony meetings throughout our life and what we did as a kid and what we did growing up, that I think is a tremendously evening influence, and that the more women go, even with the power differential and the ability to not, baptize and all of that, inability to baptize and so on, the more we have similar experience, the more we know we really are more alike than different. And so I really encourage women to go, even though we may have a wide variety of experiences and there may be some difficulties, obviously, because talking to most men missionaries, it's in some ways the same story. It's just as hard. Gloria Steinem said it best, I think. She said, really, men don't have total freedom. They are locked in prisons just as much as women are. The difference, of course, is that theirs are carpeted and draped. and that we've all been the inside of experience that shapes us in a certain way, and for that I'm grateful. Thank you.
We have a few minutes now for comments and questions. I think it would be nicest if you could come up or at least be very loud. It would probably be nicest if you spoke right in the microphone.
I note that the men are in the small minority in this group. Let me open with my credentials. I'm a physician who grew up in medicine when the nurse always stood up when you went into the nursing station. I commanded a 1,000-bed general hospital in the military, so I've had some experience in the authoritarian structures. As a mission president in Bristol a few years ago, I was appalled at some things that I saw. I get called in the first few months, mid-month, President, I'm getting a little too close to this sister. I need to be transferred. These mid-month transfers kind of bothered me, and I started trying to ask questions. The traditions were, it was organized in the usual fashion, the tradition was that sisters were not allowed to ride bicycles, they were not allowed to ride in the mission vehicles. Even if the elders were going by in a rainstorm, they had to pass up the sisters walking out in the rain. They had strictly a hierarchical elder to them. We looked at some of these things and thought some of these things are nonsense. So we said, sister, ride bicycles if you want to. Then they said, well, will the elders fix our bicycles? I said, no, your missionaries fix your own bicycles. We put them in cars. We organized a system of a traveling sister who went around for a superseding sister's leadership structure in all of the zones, so that these young boys were not receiving reports of women's problems from the senior sisters. These things were of interest to me, and I saw a research article about the relationships in the Jewish kibbutzes, where they found that the boys and girls in the kibbutz had no sexual problems with one another. They were a family. And we postulated that this was the way a family moderates its attractiveness. Previously, the sisters had been fascinating womanhood type, and on P days, they would sort of angle to get invited by some of the elders to go to a place. We eliminated that by having an organized P day once a month where everybody, all the sisters, all the elders, were invited, and they went to museums and zoos and skating rinks, any place they wanted to go. And I went and held my interviews during that time. It was almost an instant turnaround. I stopped getting the mid-month calls. President, I've got to get away from this sister. I think that they became brothers and sisters in a fellowship of missionary work. The end results, I just leave to ask the panel to comment. Were those things useful, or were there other things we could have done to do it better? That's my question.
Well, since the mic is closest to me, I guess I'll say something about that. We had an average of about 16 sisters in our mission, four of whom I would say qualify as being dysfunctional. And so transfer days, present company, not, you know, included. And transfers were always, you know, kind of nerve-wracking because you stood a 1 in 4, 1 in 3 chance of ending up with one of those problem sisters. And they had serious problems. I did have a companion for 2 months. That, you know, was the longest 2 months of my life. And you know, it wasn't her fault and all of this sort of thing, but it was very difficult. One of the things that helped was, however, that we were able to, the sisters and elders in our mission, by and large, were able to develop good family kinds of relationships, in part because our mission president also encouraged group P-days, encouraged us to get involved with the culture. If ever there were problems with romances, it had more to do with, you know, some elder being chased by a young French girl or something like that, or vice versa. I must say that happened too. One thing, though, my mission president was pretty innovative, and I was in two song and dance touring groups with the elders. We had permission from the first presidency to dance with one another. And so we put on like a Broadway show, and this happened twice. And so about 3.5 months out of my mission experience was spent on the road doing this Broadway thing to get publicity. And I remember being interviewed by the mission president, and he said, "Sister Matthews, do you have any feelings for your dance partner?" And I went, "Oh no, President." He said, "Well, why not?" I suppose it's not surprising that in my mission, you know, I know there were a lot of couples that came out of our mission, and I think it was mostly because much shared experience. It wasn't because people were doing anything inappropriate. It was because we had learned to know each other as human beings, and so when I ran into my husband to be later on at BYU, and I didn't know his first name, I knew he was Elder Anderson, you know, that we had a lot of common good experiences and memories to share. And, you know, we could build a relationship, a different kind of relationship on that basis. So I thought that was much healthier, that the mission president wasn't pretending that there couldn't be problems. But on the other hand, he created situations that enabled us to put aside the romantic notions and get about our business that we were there for.
Okay, you mentioned a lot about, you thought you were treated different than the elder missionaries. Could you just spell out the good, the bad, what you think the differences were between the way you were treated as men versus the elders?
I was I was also lucky to have an incredibly sensitive mission president. He was very supportive of strong and intelligent women, and he and his wife had a very traditional relationship, but it was a very, very happy relationship. And because of this, he set the sisters apart as something special. He said that sister missionaries are basically better missionaries, and he was constantly pointing to them as an example to the elders. Because of this, I don't know if we had the same kind of integration that we might have had in another mission, but because of this treatment of respect and we'd have special sisters activities and special sisters gifts and things like that, we were treated with a lot of respect by the elders, and they were almost afraid of us, and I never ever crossed any elder, probably because they were afraid of me. But my mission president was in South America, and he said he went to one conference with mission presidents, and they were all complaining about sister missionaries because South America is a very hard place to live. And these mission presidents believe that the sisters whined about the life a lot more than the elders did. And he said, as they were talking about that, he stood up and he said, "I'm sorry, brethren. I cannot agree with one word you've said. My sister missionaries are the strongest and most capable missionaries that we have." Now, I don't think it's that the first presidency sent him better sister missionaries. I think it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. He perceived us as very capable and strong individuals, yet he also recognized that we related to each other and to him in a different way. We didn't need the same kind of incentives that elders did. It seemed like the elders needed a push in the back, and what the sisters, the Armanas, needed was kind of a hug. And that was all that they needed to keep going. So he did treat us differently, but he treated us with so much respect for our abilities that we did baptize more. And it's because I believe that he perceived us as perhaps Christ would, and we were able to see a vision of ourselves that we had not previously seen, because maybe we hadn't been expected to perform that high. And been treated with that kind of respect in our previous experiences.
There were, now, all of course is not roses and so forth. I do want to relate one thing that finally changed about three quarters of the way through my mission. We had, stupid rules. And I don't know whether this was just a carryover from the previous mission president, but there was this rule that sisters could not enter the elders' apartments and elders could not enter the sisters' apartments. And so what this meant was, when you'd have a district work day, you go over to the elders' apartment and, you'd have lunch, and they'd shove a table in the doorway. The sisters would eat in the hallway and the elders would be on the inside of their apartment. Now, if you don't think the French thought we were weird, it was just an amazing thing. Well, finally somebody wised up and said, at BYU they just don't let, women into men's bedroom areas and vice versa. Why don't we do that? And so somebody, I'm not sure that the mission president was even aware that this kind of stupid stuff was going on, but eventually it did change to the, I'm sure that some of the French neighbors missed that sort of hallway interaction, but, So and that goes, you can find all sorts of fun little mission stories like that of just kind of weird, goofy rules.
We have time maybe for one more question.
Well, mine's not a question, rather a comment. I went on my mission 100 years ago also, and I was recently asked if I, of course that was back in my Nazi Mormon days, and now I'm considerably not Nazi Mormon anymore, but I was asked if I regretted going, and I said not for a minute. It has impacted every day of the rest of my life in one way or another, and it's precious to me. Although it was very, very difficult and very distressing in many ways, it was really beautiful and sweet in many other ways. I guess I have a question for you, and that is, before I ask the question, which is, I guess I'll just ask the question, do you feel that way? Do you feel like this is a sweet, precious thing to you that has, you know, impacted the rest of your life for good and or evil or for change. But another thing that I have to say is it's really interesting that we're getting to a place in our culture where women are considered less valuable because they haven't gone on missions. And isn't that an interesting place to be in Mormondom?
I am really glad. I have the same experience, but I think one of, unless you're totally disillusioned, unless there's enough leavening in it, so to speak, most of us are glad we've paid the price for experiences we've had as long as we don't have to do it again. So part of it is that just a human way of assessing experience. And so there are things I'm very grateful for. There's things that I'm not grateful for, things that I would change. And what I've been most intrigued by is how I keep reinterpreting experience with each decade or with each developmental stage. And with that sense, the most recent thing that has occurred and why probably I said yes to this panel now and maybe wouldn't have 10 years ago is that I've spent a good period of the last 20 years really going through all of my beliefs, whether I think the church is ultimately true in the way they say it, so on and so on. And there were years, in fact, in which I didn't say I was a sister missionary because then say, like, well, what's the matter with you? When I found out, of course, that maybe upwards of 50% of returned missionaries had spent at least 1 year of their life in inactivity after coming back and that this was a common phenomena, I started reclaiming the authority of my own experience and that the authority of having experience in the end, I think, is stronger than the having the authority of a particular calling or the priesthood.
In the early 1980s, late 70s and 80s, after I got back, a group of the Women's Research Institute at BYU had just gotten started, and one of the things they did was try to establish a returned sister missionary club. And we had access, those of us who were officers of the club, I was the historian the first year and then the president the second year, those of us who had access, you know, there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of women at BYU who were returned sister missionaries. And, you know, about half of them refused to be identified as returned sisters. There was still this concept of stigma of, you know, you did not want to be known as a sister missionary because it would say that you were older, it would, you know, so forth and so on. And that always saddened me because I thought it was such a wonderful thing to have done. And I personally would not trade the experience. You know, this is, you know, called the rite of passage for young men. It, for me, it was just invaluable in terms of, you know, as you brought up, whoever the heck brought it up, of getting to know young men as human beings and not as objects of, you know, potential date or whatever. That was so valuable to me. You know, especially coming from BYU, it was really nice to see the human side of some of these freshman elders. So,
well, there's not a stigma anymore, by the way. No, lots of guys say that they only want to date return missionaries. So,
All right. On that very positive note, our time is up. Thank you all for coming. Let's have one more hand for our panelists.